Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live this weekend edition on 101.3 KPCG, online we're at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com. Lots of really interesting stories today. The tension between the United States and North Korea, it's getting to be a crisis. That's what some people in the military think. Getting pretty serious details about that. Also, ESPN got rid of about 100 people. Not everybody's happy, and there's some ideas about why their ratings are dropping. We'll talk about that as well. Also, remembering the lost troops of Operation Eagle Claw, that and more. This edition, Trump Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. Online, we're at kpcg.fm as well. Thanks for joining us here on this weekend edition. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. And send any emails you have to comments at kpcg.fm. Lots of stories to get into today. The first one here is that some economic news. And it's whenever you look at Drudge Report and they have their economic news update, they always have the little Walmart smiley guy. Today he was a frowny guy. So you know that's not a good sign if he's a frowny guy. And GDP was only up 0.7%. Economy posts slowest growth in 3 years. Sad news.
It was depressing to go on that website and see a gigantic sad face right at the very top. First thing you look at, it just catches the eye. And those are numbers that seem similar to what we had under the Obama administration. So at least right now, not a whole lot is different.
It's been pretty consistent, yeah. So, but consistently not great.
Right.
You know, we supposedly came out of this great recession from the 2008 or so. And in maybe some ways we have, but the numbers really aren't that good.
Well, I think every nation around the world is struggling for growth except for China. Well, China has slowed down too, but they're still growing in more than 1%. Most other nations are lucky if they get 0.3% or a little less than 1%. So I think it's just a worldwide problem, and a lot of it's just the debt. We're not getting rid of the debt. We're just putting it off further and further in the future. And I think until we deal with that debt, this is just going to be the way the world functions.
Yeah, one of the companies having problems that's been in the news recently is iHeartRadio. And they took on a lot of debt around the 2008 time period, maybe shortly after that, because, you know, you guys remember, I mean, it was lots of companies started failing, other companies came in and bought a lot of things up, but they took on the debt. And then the debt comes due, and I don't know if they just thought they'd be able to make enough to pay it back or whatever, but I don't think that's happened. Media is a difficult world right now to make money in. They have a list of the worst jobs, and being a reporter is one of them, being a journalist. So not that it's not a valuable job or a good job, but it's a difficult world to make a living in that field.
Yeah, well, I think there are so many free platforms now. Mm-hmm. You can go on to, you don't have to pay a subscription for, you don't have to buy a newspaper. It's just hard to make income, and then advertising doesn't always cut it. So I think it's, for reporters, it's just, unless you have a big name, you probably don't get paid enough to make the bills.
Well, and journalism's changing because really good quality journalism sometimes isn't valued anymore. And it's just, we're going to talk about that in a little bit because ESPN got rid of 100 people. Some of them aren't happy. And they say that they got rid of the good journalists and kept the quote-unquote carnival barkers. Not to be mistaken with the Bob Barkers. So, you know, where they're louder, flamboyant, maybe, very opinionated. And it's just opinion pieces as opposed to actual factual journalism. So we'll talk about that more later because it's a really interesting situation there at ESPN. And it's interesting not just if you're a sports individual. It has a lot more to do with it has a lot going on more than just sports there. And we'll talk about that situation as well. Well, another story today here is from the Associated Press. U.S. Admiral says North Korea crisis is at worst point he's seen. It's easy to kind of get into the thinking that North Korea just always does the loud talking about things and the big threats and they don't do anything, but people are starting to take them more seriously, it looks like. The senior U.S. Navy officer overseeing military operations in the Pacific said Thursday that the crisis with North Korea is the worst point he's ever seen, at the worst point. But he declined to compare the situation to the Cuban Missile Crisis decades ago. It's real, Harry Harris Jr., commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, said during testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Harris said he has no doubt that Korean leader Kim Jong-un intends to fulfill his pursuit of a nuclear-tipped missile capable of striking the United States. The admiral acknowledged there's uncertainty within U.S. intelligence agencies over how far along North Korea's nuclear and missile programs are, but Harris says it's not a matter of if, but when. There's no doubt in my mind, he said. Fox News poll says 53% are in favor of military action to stop North Korea nukes.
Well, we've spent probably about 20 years laughing at North Korea, and so you'd think during that whole time North Korea would be improving its capabilities at least somewhat. And so now it seems like we're finally starting to take them seriously. Hopefully there's enough time for us to take them seriously before something horrible happens.
Yeah, and where would those missiles go? West Coast. That's where they would hit. California, Washington.
Yeah, well, and there's two other concerns, too, is that without nuclear weapons, North Korea is still a big threat to South Korea. Just by using conventional weapons, they have hundreds of artillery pieces trained at Seoul, the capital there. And at a minute's notice, they can send down thousands of projectiles and kill thousands of people in less than a minute. So conventionally, there's a lot they can pose a big threat to South Korea, just with a lot of civilian casualties. But then, even if North Korea doesn't have a nuke that can hit the United States, they're not that far from South Korea. They're not that far from Japan, two other major allies of the United States. And so, even if North Korea can't hit America today, the crisis is important because it can just make tensions between Japan and South Korea worse and start a war between those nations, and that would just be another situation that would be very terrible.
The leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, relatively young fellow, he is in one of the latest Time magazines. They have their 100 most influential people, and he's in there as a volatile dictator, they say. But here's some of what they say about him. They say after 5 years in power, there are no signs that the mercurial and corrupt Kim is mellowing since prep walking his uncle out of a party meeting and having him shot soon after. Kim has been on a murder spree, executing more than 300 people, often in public with firing squads. He is widely believed to have ordered the recent murder of his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, which I think we've all seen the video of that, with a VX nerve agent in Kuala Lumpur Airport. One of the two female assassins, perhaps reflecting Kim's reported sense of humor, wore a T-shirt that had LOL on it. Laugh out loud, I guess. So they say the initial hopes that the Swiss-educated third-generation dictator would be a reformer have been abandoned long ago because he is even more bold maybe than his father was in some ways. And like they say, he's been on a murder spree of people he knows, so he obviously doesn't care about people he doesn't know.
Yeah, well, I think leaders in his position, in order to gain relevance, they have to become more extreme, especially if the nation falls into complacency or if North Korea wants to be seen in the world or viable, you could say. He needs to be more extreme than his grandfather or his father. And that's exactly what he's doing inside of North Korea, but also basically threatening the United States with nuclear Armageddon. In response, there's probably the biggest U.S. Navy presence there in a long time, off of Korea. So he is influencing world events. Unfortunately, he is in a lose-lose situation because even if he can send off a nuclear weapon, there's enough firepower surrounding him that North Korea would be, it would be a difficult campaign, but North Korea would still probably lose quite heavily.
Mm. It would be really interesting to see like what their news reports are. They're probably out there, I guess, if you looked for them, but like their internal propaganda, because they're always hyping it up like they're about to attack America. And so I wonder what if they're at a fever pitch over there. They probably are at this time.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to comprehend the situation in North Korea. The people there think he's God. And even though he's executing people in public, they still somehow think that it's perfectly fine for their God to do that. And then, of course, they're raised from youth to believe that America is basically the greatest evil ever in history. So he would probably have vast support from the people to strike the United States as well.
You know, yesterday I happened to see some older news footage of the funeral of Kim Jong-il, I believe, the last one. And Kim Jong-un was walking next to the car and so forth. And the people, you know, they show the people along the route. They're losing their minds. I mean, just, I don't know. I guess that's the best way to describe it. Crying and flailing about. And they are, you know, and now granted, I suppose you'd have to show something like that or else maybe you would get in trouble. So I always wonder how sincere they are in that. But at the same time, like you said, they do look to those leaders like they're some sort of god kings, and they're just sort of robotic in what they're doing in that nation. So it is pretty frightening condition over there.
Well, yeah, I think they're pretty sincere. At least most of them are, because you had fanatical worshippers of Hitler in a much more educated society in Germany than North Korea is. North Korea is cut off from the world for 50 years, so the people growing up, they don't know anything except what the government tells them. And so I think, and even in Japan during World War II, the emperor was God too. And despite everything he put them through, the people still worshipped him. Even though if you looked at him in person, he's not an inspiring figure. He's small, very unassuming, but people still worshipped him nonetheless. So I think North Korea, if anything, they've created a society. They've been successful in creating a society where they worship a man. And there's ample evidence in history to show that you can do that, even with a more educated population. And that's a big concern to the U.S. military, actually, is that if they do have to invade North Korea, they would send special forces to secure their nuclear facilities. And it's those North Koreans working those facilities that would decide how that war would go, because they've been educated from birth that Americans are evil. Then you see Navy SEALs coming forward with their weapons on you. They're just not sure what those North Koreans would do.
I don't know if you guys know this. What's the religious system there? They don't have much of a religion. I think it's
atheist.
Worship the leader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they don't have much of a hope of a afterlife or anything?
Not that I haven't heard anything other than the worshiping of the leader, like Grant. I think if they're a true communist state, they don't have a state religion. So
yeah.
Once you die, I suppose.
Well, the reason I was wondering about that is because in some cases, you know, say if you're a Islamic terrorist, well, they believe they're going to go to paradise. So there's a payoff in their mind. And I just wonder if somebody was going to sacrifice themselves, what's the payoff in their mind? Like, I wonder what that is.
I just think if they are totally convinced that America is just an atrocious, appalling evil, that might be enough for them. And, of course, the fact that they don't really have a whole lot to live for there could help as well. I've heard of, speaking of religion there, that they might have been setting up like these places of religious worship just to see if North Koreans would be tricked into going in. And then, of course, they'd be caught for having a religion at all. So they're... It's like the government is stalking its own people and lying in wait for them to make any wrong turn.
Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy situation over there. So that's going to be interesting to see. I mean, you check the any of the news sites today, and that's one of the top stories. This one is just sort of an interesting one. It shows you some ways that, you know, we talk about spying a lot of times. It's been in the news recently, and this headline here shows how far the CIA and others have gone to try to spy in the past. There's some documents that come out. This is from The Sun, their clever headline, "Fur, Your Eyes Only." F-U-R. CIA implanted microphones into cats in a bizarre attempt to spy on Russia. This was something they were trying to do. You know, if you ever think your cat's listening to you, he's staring at you. Maybe he is. They say declassified documents show how spy chiefs praised pioneering scientists for slitting open cats and stitching in electronic hardware to uncover their enemy's secrets. It was dubbed Project Acoustic Kitty. It was the name of Abraham's band in high school. The grim 10-million-pound program was developed over 5 years in the 1960s as a novel but gruesome new eavesdropping method. A cat's tail was used as an antenna, and a wire traveled all the way up its spine, connecting to a microphone in its ear, while a battery was housed in its chest. But on its first test, the CIA handlers watched on in horror as a Robo Kitty was run over and killed seconds into the mission. That didn't work out. What's interesting about that, besides it just being sort of strange, is you have to wonder what they're doing nowadays. You know, obviously, smartphones and things like that are just kind of built-in spying devices. There's a new movie coming out about that with Tom Hanks, where he's some sort of like eavesdropping movie, kind of based on some of the news events of the past few years. So anyway, for years, they tried all sort of inventive ways to spy on different people.
That cat had just about the worst life possible, to be sliced open and have things implanted in it like that. I'm surprised it even survived that whole operation, to have something implanted all the way up your back and then something on your heart as well.
Yeah.
And in the ear. I mean, it's just, that's a lot going on, but it just shows you maybe you never can be too paranoid.
I always thought, you know, when you pet the cat and it purrs, that it was a natural reaction. Maybe it's just the battery humming.
Yeah.
It's charging up the battery so they can listen to you.
I already don't think cats are the most trustworthy creatures. Like, it seems like every time you turn your back, they're scratching the furniture to strengthen their claws, or they'll hop on the table because they think they can eat what humans eat. And now, who knows, they could have electronics embedded inside of them.
You never know what goes on in cats' heads. I mean, we have a cat, and it comes in occasionally. It came in the house, and, you know, I'm the same guy. We know each other. We've seen each other for years. But all of a sudden, he was terrified, you know, just like crouching and then like launching himself. I'm like, what's the problem? Why do you have a trust issue? I don't know.
Well, the best way that I explain it from dealing with both is that dogs see you as masters or like friends. Cats see you as peasants. See us as peasants, because that's exactly what they do. They it's kind of just a strange difference in the attitude between the two. But going back to the Acoustic Kitty, you can still get our first album on Amazon.
I bet there's a band out there called Acoustic
Project Acoustic Kitty.
Yeah.
Even better.
That the CIA over the years has had some bizarre ways of thinking they can take down other governments. The weirdest one I've ever seen was in Cuba. During the when they're trying to take down Castro, they had two different plots. One, they wanted to put a poison in his drink. Mm-hmm. They would make his beard fall off, because they thought, like Samson, if they get rid of his beard, the people would stop following him.
Just like, as he got older, it pretty much did fall off.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember.
But yeah, they thought it was like Samson. If he got rid of his beard, his powers of leadership would vanish. And then the other one, they wanted to stir a revolution, so they sent a bunch of it wasn't the Bay of Pigs, but it was something similar to that. And their plan was to send up a flare into Havana, into the bay, so that all the Catholics in Cuba would think Christ was returning, and they'd revolt against Castro and overthrow the communist overlords. Like, those are their best ideas they had in like the 60s and 70s, and it's just bizarre.
Strange.
I actually feel happy to be a part of this nation, knowing that there are no ends to the creativity of trying to keep the country safe.
Yeah. You never know. They gotta watch out for the cats and the animals and all those things. So pretty interesting when they open up some of those documents and you find out what they were doing. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program coming up here in a bit on KPCG, and watch it this weekend as well. The Unknown Prophet. The Bible describes an end time spokesman for God called that prophet. More information about that, you can listen for that on the Key of David program. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Listen for that with your host, Stephen Fleury. and the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program coming up this weekend. Grant, you have a very interesting story for us. This is just fascinating on a lot of levels. It's from The Federalist. The real story behind ESPN's Wednesday massacre, as they call it, where they let go about 100 people, I guess, because they have declining viewership. And but according to The Federalist here, it's also because there's a left-wing politics that ESPN, when you combine a lot of these things, they've kind of made their own mess.
Right. There are a variety of factors for why ESPN is going through these layoffs. They've long been thought of as the invincible network, just the king of all sports, and yet that image has quickly declined lately. They've lost 15 million subscribers since 2011, and also to go to compound the misery, they've spent, I think, $8 billion on TV rights for the NFL and for NBA just to broadcast live games. So whenever you're losing billions of dollars a year in subscribers and you're paying billions of dollars a year for live sports, at some point you're actually running out of money. And it seems like from projections, various projections, that 2021 is the year where ESPN will actually start losing money. They'll actually start going into the negatives.
Wow. Yeah, they were looked at as pretty invincible there for a while. They're referred to as the mothership by some former employees. And but they've been having problems. They got rid of about 40 or 50 a year or so ago, and then there was another 100 here on Wednesday. And some fairly big names were let go as well. I'm not familiar with all of them. Some of them were a lot of hockey guys.
Yeah,
were let go.
And
baseball guys,
too. Yep.
And then the biggest name that everyone would know would be Trent Dilfer, former quarterback, and then he was a football analyst. And so sometimes it happens. It's a money saving thing. But there's some contention there among obviously the former employees and the ones that stayed, where they don't like the direction ESPN's going, and they feel like they've kind of put all their eggs in this sort of political left-leaning basket, and they're trying to combine sports and politics and missing the mark because they're offending at least half their viewers.
Right, and that is obviously a really big problem. And they're just making the problem worse by doing the equivalent of tossing a few deck chairs off the sinking ship, hoping that will somehow right the ship. In other words, cutting a few employees when that is such a small amount of their cost. So they're not really approaching it the right way. They're not doing anything to necessarily change the programming, which could be an even bigger issue. The second thing here after them overpaying for broadcasting rights was the effect of cable cord cutting. So a lot of people are dropping their cable packages. ESPN claims that it has nothing to do with them. And yet for a long time, ESPN has basically extorted people into buying cable because you cannot watch it without a subscription. It's not a free service. And broadcasters have to also buy ESPN's other channels like the Lifetime Network, History Channel, all these other networks owned by Disney. So they say, well, we know everyone wants to watch our sports channel, but you also have to buy all these other channels that most people would not even watch.
Yeah, and that's been a major frustration for myself personally because I've had cable on and off. I don't have it now. I haven't had it for a while. But growing up, I loved to watch NBA basketball. And NBC carried it. You could get a doubleheader, tripleheader on a Sunday. And it gave you a chance, and I think it gave the viewers a chance to start to identify with teams and identify with stars because you get to watch them. And I know the games are out there in ESPN, but if you don't have cable or, you're not in that situation, they don't start airing games on network TV until, it's just only a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't have a chance to get to know these players or identify with them. I think, in my opinion, it hurts the fan base. Because if I don't know who's on the team and I haven't watched them, I'm not interested. Washington Wizards, I know like one guy, two guys in there. Atlanta Hawks, don't really care.
Mm-hmm.
If I had seen them throughout the year, yeah, maybe I'd care a little more. Maybe I'd have a little more invested in what they do as a team. But they put all their money on a couple of guys, LeBron, Durant, a few others. Well, that's fine, but when they're not playing each other, who's going to watch it? I just think they've so shut the gate on just casual fans becoming more interested in the game and in the players that at the end of the day you do hurt your bottom line.
that is really a great point. Like you said, they don't start putting games on ABC, which every TV would have, until well over halfway through the season. So you don't even have a chance to establish a connection with any of the teams. And then pretty much it's right into the playoffs with a bunch of teams you've never even seen all year. So that ESPN's putting all of its money into hoping that people will buy the cable package and also buy all their other channels. So they're extorting the broadcasters, and they know that a lot of people will buy cable just because of ESPN. The logic there goes, however, if a bunch of people are buying cable just because of ESPN, if a bunch of people are now dropping cable, they're dropping it just because of ESPN as well. So ESPN does have to assume some responsibility here, and then the question is, why exactly is that taking place? Their ratings have been falling, so that's even proof as well that it's not just people dropping cable because of other online subscriptions. It's literally because people are not enjoying ESPN as much.
Same thing's happening to Fox News. Yeah. Because they're taking out all the people that people have enjoyed watching. I read an article about that last night where they said they think it's going to be the end of Fox as they know it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're taking away what people wanted to see, bringing in new people. Maybe that'll go that way, maybe it won't. But some people have kind of looked at Fox as sort of like the last vestige of maybe mainstream media that is maybe at least will give you sort of both sides on some level. And once that's gone, what do you have? The choice between, you know, CNN,
MSNBC.
MSNBC.
All of the local channel networks.
They're all telling you the same thing, and it's all very much propaganda from one side. And ESPN's gotten into that same market. And there's a great quote there in that Federalist piece where they talk about, hey, you want to see the highlights? That's great, but first we're going to lecture you about gun control.
Mm-hmm.
They just want to watch the highlights.
You want to watch the live game? Well, we have to tell you a little bit about transgender rights. Like, those are not hypotheticals. Those things have actually happened on the network. You know, before you can watch this program, you have to also hear about how all the legislators in North Carolina are bigots because of their bathroom bill. Those things have actually happened repeatedly. Even just this morning, I saw a couple of clips from ESPN where they're talking about the Trump travel ban. I don't think that was from recently. I just saw it online. But, you know, how does that even relate to sports, except for in the very slightest of ways?
I think people want to separate their lives into a few different categories. And I think politics or news is in a certain category. And I think sports or entertainment is kind of in another category. And even if you don't agree with somebody, you can maybe agree you both like the Thunder. And you want to watch them, and just let it be.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want the political leanings just hitting you over the head constantly. The Kaepernick thing, that was a whole other thing, where they just kept talking about it and talking about it. He wouldn't stand up for the anthem.
And they said it was heroic. That was their take on it.
Right. And now even with him, no NFL team's interested in him. And so there's been a few people that says, well, that's not fair. You know, he's being, you know, persecuted against or whatever. Well,
it's his choice.
I mean, he chose not to stand for the national anthem. Can't they choose to not play him? I mean, choices are choices,
yeah,
right? So
exactly.
Anyway, not to get into that too much. But, I mean, all that stuff was kind of front and center for ESPN. And like they point out in this Federalist piece, yeah, some people might agree with it, but a lot of people don't. They just wanted to have you do what you kind of were good at, which was broadcast sports. They're trying to expand it into areas they shouldn't get into, and the viewers are leaving.
Yes, and this Federalist piece brings out a really interesting point. It actually shows how this tilt toward left-wing politics on ESPN actually was a failed attempt at a solution, because they were responding to their higher broadcast costs, they were responding to their subscription losses, and they were also responding to their lower ratings. They thought that if they could bring politics into the network, which a lot of people watch, then they'll have an umbrella of people who are interested in sports and then also people who are interested in politics. They thought it would actually increase their viewership. But the thing is, if you combine those two, like you said, most people don't actually like that at all.
I really think it comes down to kind of two main things. I think it's the politicizing of the shows, and I think it's oversaturation. I mean, even if you like the product, how much of it can you take before you're like, well, that's enough? How many games do you want to watch a week? One, two, maybe? You know, do I want to watch the pregame, the game, the postgame, the talk the next day about the? It's kind of, it's just too much. Even if I like it, like there are some of the guys there at ESPN that have a radio show, a TV show, this show, or that show. What are you going to spend your entire day watching their programming? And that's just one network. And I think, and this is probably true across media. And I just wonder. I don't know where the balance is, but it just seems like you can oversaturate your market to where we only have 24 hours in the day, and we spend some of that sleeping, I think. And there's sort of this idea like we're going to make your life be all about ESPN or all about whatever the thing is. Nobody has time for that or cares enough to commit that much to it. Like even their website frustrates me personally because there's like 18,000 new things every day. I'm like, I don't even I just want to know what the sports score was. That's right. All I want to know about. And maybe one piece about a player I'm interested in. Beyond that, I just can't handle it all. And I wonder if that's a big part of it too, just oversaturation.
Yeah, I think some people would probably not be too interested in a lot of the sports talk. And with a lot of these cuts at ESPN, they're cutting reporters, people who just give you the straight scoop on what happened. They're not cutting the opinionated guys who have their own shows and who the debate style shows, which actually I'm not surprised they didn't cut those. It seems like people want opinions more than they want the facts a lot of the times now. Not everybody, but that does have an audience. But they are getting away from more live games by doing that still. ESPN used to have the best football game of the entire week, and now it's like, you know, maybe seventh or eighth best of the week because the Sunday night football game took over on NBC as the better game of the night games of the week, not the Monday night game on ESPN. All the primetime games on CBS or Fox over the weekend are better games than the Monday night game as well. So ESPN is not really the worldwide leader in sports when it comes to football. They used to have a lot more baseball games. They used to actually show hockey, which they don't have any of at all anymore. And then, of course, basketball, they're not showing enough on their local channel that everyone actually has access to. So in every single way, they're not really showing enough live sporting events that everyone wants to see.
And Washington Post has a write-up to Stephen A. Smith, who's quite a well-known personality on there. He fires back at criticism that he should have been among the ESPN layoffs. Oh, so one of the former guys said that he should be laid off because he's a this guy Perlman, he says, our zest for a well-reported story has been overtaken for the mindless carnival barkings of hacks like Stephen A. and Skip Bayless. Now, that's his opinion, okay? But anyway, and Skip's not even there anymore. He's over at Fox. But so Stephen A. Smith came out and was really upset. Now, you can understand it, but he tried to make it into a racial issue. So we won't get into any of that. But anyway, it's at Washington Post. And he mentioned that Perlman guy mentioned Stephen A. and Skip, and of course those two different races there, so he kind of lumped in everybody. But anyway, so now you're getting that in the mix again, politics, race, all that sort of thing. So it's kind of a back and forth, but really just interesting because it just highlights that the media is changing. You know, if ESPN's having problems, who's not having problems? Because they were kind of like the one. I mean, I remember just a couple of years ago reading about how they were sort of indestructible. Like, well, you know, you got to watch the live games, so they got you.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore.
Yeah, a lot of other networks have live games now, and a lot of those networks are actually showing better games than the ones ESPN even has. I mean, even TNT takes a lot of the best basketball games away from ESPN, so they're not really showing the best games of any sport.
Yeah, and people really like TNT with Barkley and Kenny Smith and Shaq and all those guys on there. They have some interesting banter back and forth. But anyway, it's interesting. It's not the Federalist. The real story behind ESPN's Wednesday massacre does highlight this, the changing media landscape. And Washington Post as well. Stephen A. Smith fires back at criticism that he should have been among ESPN layoffs. He makes $3.5 million a year, by the way.
It's a good job. I think he's good at it, too. I actually enjoy listening to him.
Yeah, but I've never minded him.
But the thing is, no matter how successful those talk shows are, you still are not showing live sports during that time.
Yeah. And what are you going to talk about? After a while, it does start to get a little political.
Right.
So a pretty interesting story. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And thanks for following us on Twitter at kpcgfm and sending comments to comments@kpcg.fm. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. Abraham, changing gears and talking about time travel. Have you ever time traveled?
Not that I know of.
Not that you're aware of.
Yeah.
It's always funny. There's, you know, people always have these theories about time travel, and there's different pictures, like historical photos, where there's somebody in there that looks like somebody that's famous now.
Right.
And they'll always say, oh, look. And then there's this one video clip of, I think it was a Mike Tyson fight from the 80s, and somebody holds something up in the audience, and it looks like a cell phone. And right. So people are pointing at that like, ah, look, he's a time traveler. not happening. But there's this professor instructor from UBCO. He says time travel is mathematically possible, and we just don't have the materials to do it. So how is he figuring this?
Yeah, this is really interesting subject. It's also quite complex. And so if you... I'll try to explain it the best that I can. But if you really want to dive into it, you have to go research on your own, because it deals with stuff that's very complicated and specific. But basically, he wrote a book on time travel, and he's a mathematician. And he believes that based off of Einstein's theory of relativity, that it is possible to time travel just with math, that you can create a formula that allows for time travel. And basically, this is how it's possible in the, I think, the most basic way of explaining it. So Einstein's theory of relativity is that no matter where we're standing or sitting in relation to each other, light travels at the same speed. Doesn't matter if you're 100 yards away, if you're right beside like a flashlight, or if you're a mile away, the light's traveling at the same speed, even though our relative perspectives are all different. And so based off of that, that time and space are related. So time is how long it takes for something to travel or move or whatever it is. Space is where we all are, like a spatial awareness, basically, where we are in relation to each other. And that even though things are traveling at the same space or same time, people, based on where they are, might view it differently. Just like when you're driving in a car, we all have different, depending where you're sitting in the car, that things look different to you.
Sure, because if you're traveling 65 miles an hour, you're traveling that speed in relation to the highway, because the highway doesn't move.
Yeah.
If somebody next to you is traveling at 67 miles an hour, in relation to you, they're traveling 2 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and different points in the distance look like they're moving slower, even sure. though you're moving fast. And
it's relative to something else.
Yeah.
How fast you're going relative to what, or you know, whatever it might be.
Yeah, exactly. So based off of that, Einstein thought that, well, gravity affects time and space. And so if you can manipulate gravity somehow, or harness it, that you can change where you are in time and where you are in space. So basically what this professor took the idea that if you curve time and space around a circle, then you can go back in time. Because instead of time and space moving in a straight line, you make it into a circle,
mm-hmm.
and then you're repeating back on yourself. So that's his theory. And to do this, it would take like gravitational waves and different things like that. So I'm not sure how they would produce the kind of distortion that would be needed to make a circle. But that's the idea,
mm-hmm.
that you make a circle of time and space. And so you're repeating back on the same time and space you were before when you started. And that's what the time travel would be.
Well, it's interesting, because when you do get into like some of the more complex math and the way the universe works, you do start to see some really interesting things. But then it always comes back to the fact that we don't have the power to control those elements, or we don't have, say, like he says, the materials. For example, I remember when I was in college and had a particular class, and they were talking about how experiments have shown that the faster you travel, the less time affects you. And so in theory, so we all have the same question. Well, theoretically, if we traveled fast enough, like time would no longer hold us. It wouldn't affect us. And he said, well, yeah, theoretically that's true, but you don't have enough energy. There's nothing with enough energy that wouldn't burn up before you reach that speed. So we're dealing with just a lack of the materials needed, the power needed to make those things happen, but you can see them. And that's what's really fascinating about studying some math and some science, when it's good math and good science, is that you can really start to see sort of like the way the universe works. It's not just some magic. Like there's actual laws to it that control it. And it does make you think, well, if you could control those laws, couldn't you change like our reality a little bit? And so it's fascinating to think about, but then we're always left with that same conclusion that, yeah, but we can't do that.
Yeah, exactly. I think what all these show us is that mathematically, based off of numbers, there are many things that are possible just based off of theory and just using numbers in a theoretical situation. But when it comes to reality, it would appear that we are created with limitations. And there's nothing we can do to break out of those things. That's just the way we were designed, is that humans have a life cycle. And no matter what we do, we can't break out of it. And that everything physical, everything made of atoms, decays and turns into something else. The energy turns into something else or moves into something else. And then the matter dissipates and becomes dust. That's a law. That everything physical decays over time. And so when we're talking about time travel, how do you combat those laws? Because those are laws. They're not things that we haven't designed a material to get stronger with time for infinity. Everything. So how do you get around those laws? And no matter how we do it, there are, like you said, if you travel fast enough, your particles they move slower. And so you age slower than if you were moving at the normal speed we are. So there's that kind of thing, but we don't have any kind of propulsion or material, and we would die probably moving at that speed. We don't know. All those things would keep us limited to the reality we're in, and that's just something to think about.
Yeah, because what's fascinating about it is, and certainly if you look at the Bible and you believe it, it talks about a spirit realm, which is different than the physical realm. And, sometimes people kind of would just make that, or think of it maybe in some sort of like a magical interpretation, I guess.
Yeah.
But you can almost begin to see how that could occur mathematically. And we can't totally, but like for the example of time not affecting us, the faster we move, you think, wow, there's some law that like breaks you free of time. And, but we can't get there. But it does start to open your mind a little bit to just the fact that there is a way that things work. It's not just snap your fingers. I mean, there's laws in place, and obviously we're limited. And so I think the natural question should be, well, why are we limited? Well, somebody put a limit on it for a particular purpose. And that's what they, I think, struggle with in the scientific community.
Well, yeah, exactly. I think this example from this professor exactly illustrates that, where there's a theory and it's not crazy. It makes sense, but we're limited to our physical materials that we have around us that exist. And so it should make us ask, well, was that, it seems like it was intentional. It's not that evolution hasn't caught up enough to where, oh, we can time travel in the future because we'll evolve or materials will get to that point. That doesn't make any sense. We're in this particular reality and in these particular limits of laws because there's a purpose. And as you said, I think we should ask, well, why are things the way they are? Why are there these laws that bind us to our reality? And once you start looking at the reason for that, you start answering more questions than just science.
Yeah.
And that's what's exciting. Things like this, actually, it's not just about math and science and theory of relativity. It's actually about why humans are the way they are And once you understand that, then everything makes sense.
Yeah, really fascinating. UBCO instructor says time travel is mathematically possible. Pretty interesting write-up. One other one you've got for us today, this is from Task and Purpose. Remembering the lost troops of Operation Eagle Claw, the failed Iranian embassy hostage rescue mission. I think we all know of that event. I didn't know of it as the name of by the name of Operation Eagle Claw, but that's the name of the mission they went on.
Yeah, so this happened 37 years ago. Actually, just happened a couple hours ago on April, or sorry, a couple days ago on April 25th, for a historical anniversary. But basically, President Jimmy Carter, he ordered a military rescue of all those hostages in the Iranian who were taken hostage by the Iranian Revolution in 1979. And so this was one of the last things he did as president. And a lot of people think this contributed to his loss to Ronald Reagan. And so Operation Eagle Claw was a base off of the USS Nimitz, a bunch of helicopters and planes would launch and take storm the place where the hostages were and take them back. But upon, as they began the operation, they found out that the situation was compromised. The Iranians found out about it somehow, or it just wasn't going to work. So they aborted the mission and they were coming back, and a helicopter ran into a plane, an EC-130, and 8 people died. 5 airmen and 3 Marines were killed in the explosion from the aircraft that ran into each other. And so no one died in combat. The mission actually never got to Iran to start the mission, but people died just from a botched and poor planning and that kind of thing. And so it was a huge blow to President Jimmy Carter, and America looked helpless against the Iranian regime at this point until Ronald Reagan came as president.
Yeah, and then when he when President Reagan came in, they pretty much right away changed to Iran let the hostages go right at that point, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they made a very, very specific political point
yeah.
about that. But, you know, what's interesting is that there's been too many of these types of missions where we have superior power, we should be able to get in and get out or do whatever we need to do pretty easily, and things just don't work out as you would hope. And so, again, that's something to think about. Like, why is that? Why do we have a history of that recently?
Yeah. I mean, ever since 1979, how many hostage rescues have there been or assassination attempts on leaders? The most famous one, probably Osama bin Laden. You have Navy SEALs go in and take him down. Then you have just even the last couple of years, we have American hostages in Iran again.
Right. And we paid a boatload of money, and then a few other things that happened as well, which was even talked about just a couple of days ago on the Trump Daily Show.
Yeah, exactly. So there's this, looking at this history, it's not out of context. This is a situation we're always dealing with, and we always will, probably as long as the Iranian regime is there, that they'll try to take Americans hostage. They already have American hostages right now. They're arresting American citizens in Iran, or Iranians who have dual citizenship. So, I mean, they already have plenty of Americans in prison today. And so the interesting thing about this Operation Eagle Claw is that the 8 people who died, they didn't die in vain. In fact, it sparked a huge reformation in the American military because no U.S. serviceman should die outside of combat. And some people die in accidents, but this is something that could have been avoided if there is better planning and better unity of command. And so it was this event that really sparked a complete overhaul of the U.S. Army. They created the Special Forces Operational Command, which has been used very successfully over the years with the Navy SEALs, the Army Rangers, and the Green Beret, using them much more effectively in these type of situations. And it even caused an overhaul of the whole U.S. Army to where it is today, where it's a professional army, highly trained, highly skilled. And so this event really sparked a lot of change because the U.S. Army was in decay from complacency. But I think when we look back on this, it's almost 40 years ago that this happened. And I think that the U.S. Army is getting to a point where it was 40 years ago, where we made lots of changes, but events recently show that the U.S. Army isn't what it used to be. Either we're not able to, like you said, project power anywhere we want, or more restricted. We make a lot more mistakes. That raid in Yemen, where that one Navy SEAL died, like the first day of President Trump's administration, that happened. So there's lots of instances where these events are becoming more common again. And usually it's caused from poor leadership in the U.S. Army, poor leadership politically, and then also just a lack of will to deal with our enemy. Because if in reality, what should have been the U.S.'s response to Iran? Should it have been a small special forces operation or something much bigger?
Right, and that I think if you want to look at one maybe, say, bright spot, would be when the Reagan administration went after Gaddafi's son,
yeah,
and killed him, and you didn't hear really much from him after that. But they, you know, they'd made a pretty surgical strike there, and so, and then too, you know, if we look at Iran today, and you look at North Korea today, it doesn't take much to think about where Iran's going to end up. But Iran's more powerful than North Korea is, and more influential in the Middle East, certainly. So, you know, we tried to make this deal with North Korea in the Clinton administration. We haven't dealt with the problem. A new leader came on the scene. The old one died in North Korea. He's worse than the last one, I guess you could say. And so what are we waiting for with Iran? You know, we hope it works out. We hope they become somewhat moderate. It's not going to happen. It's going to become more and more intense with them. And it's pointed out in plenty of writings at thetrumpet.com where you can read very specifically about that and why it's going to go that way. But even just historically, you can look at it. You know, we've been dealing with North Korea for a long time. We've been dealing with Iran for a long time. Leaders come, leaders go, things change. But the reality is, if you don't stop the foundational problem in those nations, the problems get worse. And as bad as a nuclear North Korea is, how bad is a nuclear Iran? I mean, it's worse.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the overall context we need to keep in mind with these operations. It's not just about getting American hostages back. I mean, that does happen sometimes, but it's more about nuclear Armageddon, basically showing nations that they can't get nuclear weapons, making a point. And I think for the U.S. Army, their big redemption was Desert Storm in 91 when they went and invaded Kuwait and got rid of Saddam's army there. And it was a huge missed opportunity because 2003, I think we're more familiar with Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. And the media thought that was shock and awe, but that was nothing compared to what America did in 1991 to Iraq. Just, we annihilated their whole army in 100 hours. The whole Iraqi army was on the run. We could have walked into Baghdad and taken down Saddam in basically like 4 days, but it didn't happen because there was too much pressure on President Bush to back off. So he did. If the media didn't have that pressure on him, we could have gotten the Saddam in 1991. And that would have been a huge message to any Middle Eastern country that if you mess with the United States, we'll destroy your whole army in 4 days.
Right.
But we let him go scot-free. He had chemical weapons. He tried to make a nuclear bomb too, Saddam Hussein. And then in 2003, when we invaded, it was so much harder. And it would cost American lives, and it's still a debacle to this day. And so I think President Bush, the younger, George W. Bush, there was more ties to Al-Qaeda through Iran than Iraq in some ways. And I think the big missed opportunity was not invading Iran, because we had just as much justification to do that than Saddam Hussein.
Yep.
And if his father took care of Saddam, then that would have been the only option. And we could have taken care of Iran back then, too.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because not having the courage or the will to finish the job means that the next group's going to have to go back. And so there's always this thought of, well, we need to protect American lives, which is a very noble thought. But if you don't finish a job, you end up costing more lives.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you have to go back again, and it's a worse situation and so forth. So really interesting. That's from Task and Purpose, Remembering the Lost Troops of Operation Eagle Claw, the Failed Iranian Embassy Hostage Rescue Mission. I've got a book on that that time period. I'm eager to get into it, but I got to get through some other ones first. It's one of my summer projects.
Yeah. It's really fascinating that since 1979, the world changed. You had this hostage siege and then the one in London where Margaret Thatcher sent in the SAS and they took care of them. So you have when Iran, when this regime came, the current regime in Iran, they attacked the West. And we had a pretty minimal response to them.
Yeah, really interesting time period in history. And I was born like a year before then, so for whatever that's worth. As were many millions of people. Yes. Yeah. That's about all the time we have for today on Trumper Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program. The one this week is The Unknown Prophet. You can see that at thetrumpet.com and on local television stations. Check your listings. And also Trumpet Daily Radio Show and the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program that's coming up this weekend here on Trumpet Radio 101.3. For myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau, thanks for spending some time with us today and this week. We'll talk to you again on Monday. You're listening to Trumper Radio, 101.3 KPCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.